This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
This particular episode is dedicated to the listeners. And we already have two callers on the line. The first one, the last four digits is 9281. And the second person, the last four digits for you are 9801. So I'm going to go over the first person first, and then we're going to go with the second person. Then we'll, if anybody else calls in, we'll get some more questions. We also have some questions from listeners from the Reddit forums as well and some other social media forums. So we've got plenty of material to go over, and we're going to see how much we can get to. And if we need to do another show, we definitely will. Sound good, Dr. Lyle?
Sounds good.
Fantastic. Okay. And our first caller is Lee. Lee, welcome to the program. How are you doing?
Thanks. Hi. Good. So, Dr. Lyle, I have three questions. The second two are related. Two of them are sort of about theory, and one of them is more about application. So the first question, you have this, like, two-factor model for what women are looking for from men, which was the attractiveness and the resources or stability, and then the men have the single-factor attractiveness model. So, and then I recognize that you're also talking about additional factors that come into play in terms of, like, compatibility with personality and other things like that. So my question, though, wouldn't the equivalent be for a woman looking to for a man's ability to provide for her be him looking for her to be a good nurturer? So she's taking on this sort of physical and survival risk to divert her attention from her own survival and well-being to keep her child alive. And I know because I have kids how you can't believe how much work that is until you actually do it. And I can imagine, like, in the Stone Age, just how much of a survival sort of risk that would be. So if a man is going to invest his resources and his energy into a pair bond situation, wouldn't he be seeking somebody that he could determine in some way that whether she's likely to nurture that child and keep that child alive? Or does that play into your model, like, in another way, or am I missing something there? What are your thoughts?
What happens is that when you're speaking fast and you're not carefully, you know, talking to a professional audience and watching every word, you can sometimes say things that you wind up not getting construed exactly the way you meant. When I talk about women being a two-factor model and male model, what I'm talking about is mostly about sexiness. And so we're not talking about all the factors involved in mid choice. And so it's going to turn out that if women come with a bunch of resources, that's not going to impact the sexiness assessment that males will typically have of females. But females will actually be able to more completely integrate and actually have a more complex mosaic when it comes to their overall sexiness assessment of a male, as they integrate not only what he looks like, but also, and not only his resource acquisition capability, but also his likelihood of sharing those resources with her and its reliability. So that's why, because the female has more on the line here in terms of the male has the female in what we're going to call a cruel bind. And that is that if he walks off and leaves, he has much less investment in the offspring than she does. So as a result, he doesn't have to be as panicked about her reliability in these circumstances as she does about him. And so it's going to turn out that female psychology winds up being more flexible aesthetically issues, whereas male is less flexible. So if you are a
Dr. Lyle, your audio is getting a little bad. Your audio is getting a little bad. So, yeah.
Okay, hold on. Is this any better here?
Yes.
Any better at all? Okay.
Yeah.
So when I'm saying that, I'm more talking about this. Now, if we're going to be talking about pair bond judgments, long-term judgments, all personality factors and intelligence factors, and even beyond personality intelligence, but also contextual factors, anything affecting resources and the resources that could impact, that would include family resources and friendship alliances, et cetera. Even the contextual situation that the person finds themselves in a particular point of history in the world. In other words, if we're in a highly conflicted situation where muscles and aggression is critical for survival, we might these resources then will change in terms of the equation of how attractive people wind up being. Including maybe we live in a place where it's a palace and there's a tyrant king, and social skills for keeping everybody alive are really important. And that would be so on both sides of the equation. Mates, when they're making long-term investments, are making judgments across the big five, and they're making judgments of intelligence as well. They're making estimations of the total resource base that a partner would bring to bear on the equation, et cetera. So, yeah, I wouldn't want us to be to take my little comment about one and two factor models any more seriously than that. I'm essentially explaining why females are so much more willing to trade down when it comes to physical attractiveness than males are.
So you're essentially saying that if basically the nurturing capability or likelihood of the woman matters, but not as much as the equivalent sort of resource availability and potential matters for the woman, so it gets sort of baked into the personality assessment or the sort of
Okay. Those variances aren't as important for the reason that the female, no matter how flaky she is tremendously online and stuck with the pregnancy, where the male is not. So therefore, the importance of those issues is quite asymmetrical for male and female. And so that is exactly why we see the female willing to trade down for those characteristics where the males will not. So a male does not find a female who is intelligent and stable and nurturing, et cetera, sexier, okay, or it does not add to her sexiness. She either meets criteria on that sexiness or she does not. As he gets to know her and learns about those characteristics, he doesn't add points into that equation, whereas females absolutely do. Okay, so that's where it is that we see the two-factor versus one-factor when it comes to sexiness.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay.
Good.
So so my next question is sort of my question about application of the theory, but it's sort of a hybrid theory application question. Which is essentially, what is there sort of some global thing that I'm missing in terms of looking at this with respect to friendships? And I did listen to the previous podcast, but basically, like, I'm in a happy romantic relationship. I have two children. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's a lot of sort of rules and guidelines out there and theories supporting all that sort of relationship, but I feel like it's a lot more vague in our culture about friendship. I find friendship personally to be much sort of less satisfying, especially I think because having little kids and having so many demands on my time, it sort of throws into relief how much certain things are high expenditures of energy for me. where I feel like I'm not getting as much back. And so here's my kind of big five profile. I'm like 5th percentile neuroticism, 89th percentile openness, 99th percentile intelligence, and everything else is like kind of in the middle.
Okay.
So my friendships tend to be me playing the role of like analyze the complex situation and then advise them.
Right.
And that gives me some value, I think. It's like I like the puzzle, but it's not really two-way street. I think I could count on one hand the number of friends that I feel like we consistently can have a two-way street. So I guess my question sort of boils down to, am I missing some bigger picture theory about this, or am I just a strange person, like in terms of my kind of, you know, personality makeup, and that's why it's hard to find that kind of friendship chemistry, or is there some other sort of lens I'm just missing?
Well, you have to, I think, make sure I don't wander off topic here and miss the big point, but so reel me back if I get a little bit lost. But the fundamental issue is that all relationships are under competitive pressures. And so you are running cost-benefit analyses on every relationship. And so you are also displaying your own capabilities to the village. And you're designed by nature to try to bring your capabilities to the village in a display that is the most outstanding display that you can make. So when you've got people around you that are needy and desperate and trying to when I say that, I don't mean that in a pathetic way, but they're these, for example, romantic questions about what you should be doing about Jim and whether you should stay with him or not, et cetera. These are like really big questions. And so if you've got friends that are struggling to try to understand this, and your insights are better than theirs, and that they can tell that that's true, that they will signal their esteem for you, and they will essentially be signaling that in ways that are saying thank you, okay? And what this does is it is statistically altering it's altering your estimate of your likelihood of survival, as if you were living in a Stone Age village where them owing you would have been very important. Now, the thing is that if you are, there's several things about being an unusual person here that are notable. It is just as it is not easy, for example, for highly intelligent people to necessarily find a lot of people interesting. Because the truth of the matter is that for them, most people are not very interesting. And by interesting, that would mean that the people on the other side are displaying a value proposition to the intelligent person that it has a good cost-benefit ratio. And the truth of the matter is that if you happen to be very bright, then you are essentially not needing a lot of people's opinions or their theoretical concepts about how it is that they think the world works. It's like they're not worth talking to, and so you run up against a constraint there. So if it could be that your friends on average might be bright people, but they might not be as bright as you, and as a result of that, the value proposition that they bring just on that dimension alone may be always sort of lagging behind, and it winds up being a 70-30 trade their direction just on that issue alone. But then we go further into the fact that you're very stable. So it turns out that, or very non-neurotic. So you're in pretty good shape. You're not very needy. And the truth is that if you're not very needy and you're in a pretty high resource situation, stable pair bond, et cetera, everybody's healthy, everybody's doing pretty good shape, then essentially a big reason why we have friends is that they actually act as insurance policies. And it may turn out that you don't need a lot more insurance, that by the time you have a few people that are very competent and you've got money in the bank and you've got, you're attached to careers either your own or you've got education, or your husband's got education, et cetera. You've got family money out at the periphery if needed, if in emergencies, et cetera. If you start analyzing your situation from your true ecological context, your mind starts saying, what the hell do I need to be spending any time and energy on these people who are relatively mediocre exchanges, okay? And so that's going to make you very discriminating with respect to that. And you can tell that that's happening by the fact that they're boring. They're not that interesting, and you're not that interesting in the problems. Now, there could be a time early in a relationship with people that are, for example, more unstable and less competent than you, where you're listening to their problems and you're doing a bunch of analysis, and they are giving you feedback that you're really valuable. So that's stoking that Stone Age intuition that you're gaining chips. At the same time, you're learning because you are seeing that human beings have problems and have limitations to solving those problems that you may not have, and that you recognize them because you're a human. But you're sort of learning about humanity and humanity's variations, and you're also learning about your ability to help them, which is a potential value for you in the future. And so this, what may seem like, quote, fun and, quote, somewhat worthwhile for a few years can start to be like, okay, well, I've reached the limits of my ability here, and I'm seeing that there's limitations in their personalities that are also causing some of the chaos, et cetera. And I'm not really seeing that the cost benefit is really tilting that, continuing to tilt forward at the same delta that it was before. And so, you know what? I'm not feeling so hot about it. And so I don't think that you're missing anything in principle here. I think the truth of the matter is that for someone like yourself, who's an unusual specimen, it's going to take unusual specimens to bring a value proposition to you that's exciting. And so as a result of that, you know, you're going to find yourself often thinking it's not, you know, Judy's just not that worth it. And maybe we check in a couple, three times a year rather than a couple, three times a month. And I got a feeling I might be better off. Does this make sense?
Yeah, all that's very, very accurate. I think the other thing, now that you're saying this, is, you know, smart people are weird on top of that, right? So if you're finding someone who's interesting, they're also not really socially gelling necessarily with just sort of regular life.
Well, that's right. That's because the truth of the matter is that you're a lot of what goes on in regular life is a lot of regular people trying to establish relationships with other regular people in order to get insurance, mates, and trade processes. And so they're learning from the average Joe. And you look at the whole party and you say, there's not a brain in here that has anything in it that I need to harvest out. And I've already got better than everybody here, so forget it. It's not worthwhile. And so that this is, you know, I know this sounds very elitist, but it's the equivalent of, in this case, it doesn't just have to be intelligence, because there's a lot of intelligent people with a lot of problems that need to talk to a lot of people to try to unwind some of their messes. But but when you start to put a package together like you're talking about, very emotionally stable, very secure in all kinds of dimensions, the most important things in your life are going to be your children and angling for their future success, and your relationship with your husband, who is the primary second resource for those children's growth and development. So as a result, those relationships dominate everything. And because you don't live in a situation where these friends are literally your insurance policies, because you literally have other insurance and you have a market economy, the value of friendships is inherently quite a bit less. You will see something interesting in the world, that in the low socioeconomic status of our country, with a bunch of little single moms of averageish or low average intelligence scrambling around trying to make ends meet from day to day, you will find these friendships being a much bigger deal, because they're literally the little credit and debit exchanges on the order of $20 to help my kid get the little ticket to get in the movie are quite a big deal. And so in order to optimize these modest amount of resources that these people have, there's a much more conversation, much more checking in, much more sort of friendship maintenance behavior than is required for somebody like yourself.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, just sort of understanding why I'm treated like a therapist or an encyclopedia.
That's because you're the best brain in the room. Okay, so they're trying to harvest those abilities in order to minimize their mistakes in life, and they've really got nothing for you, and so they're going to tell you, look, you know, if you need something, Lee, you break your leg, you need me to drive you to the doctor, be there for you. You know what I'm saying? But the truth is, you're not very needy, and but they could use that brain, and they're gonna take it as long as you give it to them.
Okay, so I have one final question.
Sure.
So this is about the Big Five generally.
Yes.
So here's where I don't really know how to reconcile kind of the claim that the Big Five makes that basically the fundamental aspects of human personality can be broken down into these five categories, right? Because when I take this test online, it breaks it down into the five factors, and each of them have six subcategories under each factor. So I can be wildly different on the subcategories, but the extremes within the factor get me an average score in the middle. So, for example, for conscientiousness, like I'm really low on orderliness and dutifulness, but high on some of the other measures like achievement, striving, and cautiousness. So what does that mean? Can you say that I'm X level of conscientiousness, or is it really reducible to that?
It's really not. The truth is the Big Five because that's what arrived out of the factor analytic studies. And so remember what it's saying. It's the Big Five. Okay, so there are potentially hundreds of individual differences in people that we could synthesize down to a given person and environment, process that is repetitive, and we could see variation on that would be stable over time within individuals, and we could call that a personality variable. And if we looked hard enough, we would find that personality variable would be undoubtedly genetic in origin, just like we see out of the Big Five. So the Big Five let me give you an example of the Big Five, of how to think of it. Think of the Big Five very much in the same way that we would think about athleticism. So we think about athleticism. We could take five measurements of athleticism, and those five measurements would comprise a tremendous amount of the predictive ability of any athletic contest. So we could see, for example, how high can you jump? We would see, you know, how much weight you could clean and press, or whatever they call it, just lift off the ground and press over your head. We would see how fast you could run the 100-yard dash. We would see how long it would take you to run 2 miles. And we could see how accurately you could throw a projectile, 40 yards. And so those five measurements, if we were to do that, we could take a composite score on those five things and give everybody a percentile judgment on that, and we would have a nice smooth bell curve. And the people at the top of the bell curve would be superbly athletic, and the people at the bottom would be superbly non-athletic, and then everybody in the middle would be everybody in the middle. And we could call this construct athleticism. But then we would say, well, wait a second. We've got five subdivisions. And then somebody else could say, well, wait a second, here's something else. You know what I mean? There's something else here that doesn't quite fit any of these things, and that would be, balance. Okay, so how fast you can twirl and not lose your balance, sort of the capability of the cerebellum. That isn't in any of those five measurements. What are we going to do with that? And the answer is, I don't know. Do whatever the hell you want with it. It's not one of the big things of athleticism, but it clearly belongs in here. But it's not an excellent predictor of overall athleticism, where the other five measurements, when we build them as a composite, they essentially take up the lion's share of all the predictive power. So when we added the ability to twirl fast onto the athleticism and we try to predict people's ability at football, baseball, basketball, et cetera, we would find that the Toro variance would be very, very small amount of the variance, okay, of predicting anybody's abilities, but it would be there. It would be in running back's ability to spin out of a tackle or a basketball player's ability to do a spin move. A baseball player, I don't know, maybe spin out and then throw to first base. It might be a third baseman's ability. But it wouldn't probably have anything to do with the pitcher's ability. So we would see that that particular variance in athleticism would be not useless, but very minor. And so that's why it is that the Big Five will be forever frustrating, and that's why precisely why they start hacking apart the Big Five and looking inside the different things like conscientiousness and say, well, what do we really mean by that? Okay, and
yeah.
You're going to be able to split it in principle probably into 1,000 pieces if you want, and so it's never going to be comprehensive and fully satisfying.
No, but it doesn't weigh, like, it doesn't assign different weights to different factors. Like, let's say, like, your ability to spin and not fall over is
right
important to 5% of the sports out there, but your ability to catch a ball
right
is important to 80% of the sports out there. So it doesn't assign, like, a varying weight for that. Like, I'm just trying to sort of wrap my head around how I should. I mean, like, for example, I really like Jungian theory, but I understand that it has, like, I understand its criticisms and everything, but I think it's valuable. I think there's value to it. I also really think there's a lot of value, at least personally to me, to the Dabrowski theory of positive disintegration. But I understand that neither of those theories are comprehensive. They're not trying to sort of make that claim. They're looking at, like, one narrow aspect. And so it's just hard for me to sort of take, like, okay, well, how much of an oversimplification is this? How much distortion are we talking about when we're talking about these five factors? How, you know, what should I have in the back of my mind? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that the five factors are extremely useful. They have a fairly recent and useful underpinning that doesn't really exist in any other theory. And it's not strong and it's early, but it's very promising in a way that all other theories, Jungian theory or anybody else's theory, are completely hopeless and they have no chance. And that is that it's not just comprehensive. They're not actually theoretically elegant, and they don't integrate into a wider understanding of biology.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Jung's thinking about psychology was fine for 1915, but it's
right.
very primitive and it's way, way behind. Things don't work the way he thought they did. And so in the same way that the Big Five has a potential elegance to it that's very powerful, which is that each of the Big Five are line up very well with timeless adaptive problems for the genetic code. So openness to experience is a cost-benefit analysis that a brain makes on a question about how much we should seek novel sensations in the environment versus how much we should stay with familiar sensory patterns. And so this isn't just in humans. This is going to be brains-wide. This goes to all animal brains. So if a rabbit is trying to decide how far it goes from a rabbit hole and 100 yards is the optimum amount for that species, you will find that the average rabbit has the average amount of anxiety when it hits 99 yards, and that's enough to stop it under average circumstances, whereas a more open rabbit will go out to 150 yards. But that gene will not be as common in the gene pool because that will get selected out by foxes that will kill it more often. And so you will find that rabbits that only go 50 yards are now not optimizing their mating and food searching capabilities. So it falls in a beautiful bell curve, and the discovery that the Big Five fall in bell curves is a legitimate major scientific advance. And the notion that these are bell curves and therefore they are continua, not types. All of Jungian psychology is built on typologies, which are just fundamentally wrong. It's just not the way it works. So these are gene variations that fall in bell curves. And the Big Five, when we analyze out the 20,000 or 18,000 words that human beings use to describe each other, they factor out into these essentially six factors, the big five plus intelligence. And when we realize that human nature appears to fall beautifully in bell curves around these, we start to see underneath that we have cost-benefit analysis of the genetic code looks like they're lining up to these five these variations. So this is a mosaic, a scientific mosaic that is quite satisfying. It's going to have the imperfections that I talk about. It's going to have limitations, but it is I consider it to be this thinking, but with behavior genetics integrated with the big five, I consider these to be really the cutting edge of where we are and a major advance in human thinking as to where we were, for example, by 1980.
Okay, so that clarifies a lot, because basically you're saying its claim to superiority is that it's each of the five individual factors are like sort of a necessary and complete kind of way to categorize these fundamental evolutionary elements of
problems. Human
nature. Okay. Yeah,
not just humans, but they're problems of animal behavior.
Okay. That's
okay.
That's,
and so, yeah, that's bringing an elegance to the argument that nobody's ever seen before.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
That's all very helpful.
You bet. Very good.
Fantastic. Lee, thank you very much for the call. We really appreciate it. Our second caller, I believe they are just, they hung up. So
okay,
hopefully that was
good.
A prank.
All right.
Hopefully that was a prank caller who decided that he didn't want to wait.
Very good.
But let's go over to the next question. So this is a user from from Reddit forums that I posted on regarding these questions. And the comment is, I don't have something concrete, Dr. Lyle, but I want you to talk about social isolation. In my opinion, it's the biggest problem in our time, next to lack of purpose. Humans evolved to be very social creatures, so it's obvious that by fixing the ongoing and increasing problem of social isolation, that we will find happiness. But isn't it actually in our genes? What causes people to choose going home over getting to know more people? Is this some stupid tribe behavior? Are some people are welcoming while others are not? It's not just a state, but rather a general attitude to strangers.
The person's got a lot of comments in there, and so I'll try to just sort of answer some maybe more generally and hopefully hit on what they're asking. The modern society certainly has major structural changes in it that are not consistent with human nature. And so the person comments about two things, social isolation, and they also comment about, quote, lack of purpose or meaning that people feel. And those are two things that you wouldn't have seen in a Stone Age environment. You wouldn't have seen social isolation because people essentially can't survive. They sure as hell can't reproduce without being hooked up with villages. So that would have been different than is possible for people today. People can be much more isolated today than they would have been in a Stone Age situation. And also the purpose issue is that people can be doing things where the village is not seeing what they're doing, and the village, there is no thank you process or esteem process. Where they are contributing to the absolutely all important issue of the group survival, and so so people can be sort of cut off and not hooked up in that way. Their work may leave them feeling like they're not necessary, or they're not thanked, and they're not important. Whereas people contributing in the village, all up and down the line, from the most valuable person in the village to the least valuable would certainly feel anxiety and some angst about wanting to make sure that they contributed enough to still be able to access the village's insurance if they needed it. But they would have been, you know, watching that process and doing what they could in order to become more secure and reduce that anxiety. Whereas today, you know, people can be useful to the society economically, but not really hooked into a village tribal system where they are observing the esteem that they get from what they're doing. So now the question is why it is that we are here in this way. The truth is that there's probably many reasons for it. But we can do things. We would just as soon not be responsible and at the beck and call of the village's demands of 40 other people right now, where we are the doctor, the hunter of last resort, et cetera, et cetera. So it's going to turn out that the modern environment, as these coalitions got larger and larger and we got trade economies, it turns out that we don't have to rely on villages. We don't have to be hooked into the villages in the same way. And this makes social isolation possible, and it actually makes it perfectly safe in a way that it was never safe before. We can also work in situations where we are not getting, where we are just a little cog in a machine, and we are not, and we're quite socially isolated, and even in our workplace, at which point we're not connected to a feeling necessarily of feeling like we're producing anything of value, or we're not getting any feedback for it. So we can actually, in a modern environment, has some potential liabilities associated with how it works. It also has absolutely incredible assets that blow those liabilities away in almost every respect, but not every respect. And so now the question of social isolation in general is that people differ in two ways that are important, and then there's a third way that's situational. The first way that they differ is that they differ in how socially attractive they are. So there are people that are inherently more valuable to other people, and when they display those value resources, it's very unlikely that they're going to be socially isolated because other people are going to search them out, and they're going to essentially proposition them with value propositions in order to engage them in relationships. So, you know, good looking, pleasant, funny, smart, emotionally stable people, you know, are usually not lonely and socially isolated. So that's one thing. So now it's going to turn out that in principle you could be if you are extremely introverted. And so social isolation is probably largely and significantly a derivative of people's essentially probably a combination of two major factors. Number one is going to be not very socially valuable human, which of course people will freak out over this kind of talk. You know, that's the ultimate political incorrectness, is to actually talk that there's individual differences between human beings and how valuable other people find them. But there are such things, and
I wouldn't necessarily find a thief very valuable or a murderer. So you have a point there,
right? And notice that we find one athlete worth $30 million a year, and the other athlete on the same team worth $1 million a year. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So people are dramatically different in how valuable other people find them, and so if you are not particularly valuable to the general market, then you are going to have less social opportunities, and you're going to get less social encouragement, et cetera. Now, the other thing is that you may be very introverted, and introversion is going to be one of the big five. And that's it looks to be solving the problem of how much exposure that you believe your immune system can handle from being exposed to a lot of potentially communicable diseases. And so extroverted people look to be more robust with respect to their immune function, and introverted people appear to be potentially less robust with respect to that, and most people are somewhere in the middle. So if you're someone who has some kind of magical internal device, which it looks like we may have, which can essentially assess our immune, you know, function, then and you essentially have some self-analysis that is tripping that says that you had better stay away from other people. You better keep yourself introverted. And you also are not very socially attractive. And you do not live in a situation that is conducive to group-oriented work and interaction. You may find yourself socially isolated and actually living an overall less satisfying life than had you been back 10,000 years ago living in a hunter-gatherer society. So those are how that plays out, and we are seeing in the social media revolution, we're seeing how important it is for people to get esteem from groups, and how essentially almost unquenchable the thirst is for that kind of feedback. And so it's tapping into a pretty serious and important need in human psychology.
And that's very interesting, because the next question from the same user, from the same mm-hmm. listener, is following up on this, and it looks like you answered most of this question. But the follow up mm-hmm. is, a sense of meaningfulness and purpose seems to help many people. Any idea why? And aside from the obvious ideas, he wants some evolutionary psychology explanations, like the drive to be useful. And I think you touched on that.
You are competing with other people in the village in order to gain esteem from being people are running for the most valuable player. The most valuable player is, in principle, the player that the most value would be given up in order to save them. So the most valuable player in the village is the safest player in the village. Or to be more complete and accurate, the genes of the person who is the most valuable player are the safest genes. In other words, if Big Takuna, is the most valuable guy in the village, and his kid falls in the river and it's dangerous in the river, I just might jump in the river to save his kid, but I'm not going to jump in the river to save the kid of the guy who's in the bottom 10 percentile of the village. And so so as a result, people are running for, or they are displaying for and making efforts for, to make displays that indicate that they are of higher value than their competitors within the village. And so these competitions can be friendly. They can be dancing and singing and guitar playing and so forth, and carving and et cetera. But they can also be more directly practical for survival. They're all about beauty and handsomeness. That's why people are going to fix their hair and comb it and braid it, and they're going to do all kinds of stuff. They're going to have fashion to try to make their bodies look better and more attractive, and make their minds look more imaginative if their clothing looks elegant and creative. So human beings are driven to try to make displays that indicate that they have more value than their competitors. And so this is the, I think he was saying, a drive for meaning. The Stone Age village is just full of meaning. That you've got if your little genes are running around, you've got meaning. And the meaning is, how are we going to make sure that these little things survive, and that we maintain enough status in the village that we can call on the village's insurance when we need it? And we need to look out for the village in general, because if a bunch of us go down, we may all go down. In other words, Stone Age man no more thinks about, quote, the pursuit of meaning than does an aardvark or a giraffe. It's all about trying to live as smart as you can and make all the moves so that you can make it. It's only in the modern environment where suddenly we live in artificial circumstances where the food is a steady flow, you've got more than you need, and that your temperature-controlled environments, et cetera, and nobody needs you. You're not that important. As Charles de Gaulle said, the graveyards are full of indispensable men. In the modern environment, everybody's replaceable. The greatest surgeon is easily replaceable. Any president is replaceable. There is any great player is replaceable. Like, there is nothing that is not replaceable. And so as a result, we live in a world where people can feel quite esteem deficient and feel like their lives are, quote, devoid of meaning. And anyway, so that this is what drives people to try to pursue things that are valuable to other people.
Yeah, and I'm curious to hear you expand on that, is that this is why people are esteemed deficient. That makes complete sense. With if you're easily replaceable, that would lead people to be less stable, less more anxiety, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I'll tell you what, you talk about replaceable. You know, one of my heroes in life, of course, because I grew up in California, was Joe Montana, and the guy only won 3 Super Bowls for the San Francisco 49ers, but he got hurt, and then suddenly he's replaceable. you can imagine, your status or esteem in this world is very perishable, and so as a result, we have a drive to continue to get feedback and to try to figure out what we can bring to the village to continue to maintain a flow of esteem signals which support our security and our well-being.
Now, you're talking about replaceable in terms of trading partners or business. Does this translate to friendships and mating and mates, the potential mates?
Absolutely. In other words, you are entirely replaceable. In case you don't know this, Nate, there's a fancy little technique that one day, if you ever settle down and get married, and then it turns out that if you die, then you get to, there's this little porthole that you get to look through, and you get to see that your wife is shacked up with your best friend. Okay. So, yes, we are all replaceable, and certainly there are times when there's people that are enormously valuable to us that feel irreplaceable, and in other words, we can never have those experiences again, and their losses, if we lose them, would be just huge for our well-being. That is true, but when it comes to most trading situations that define human nature, we are very replaceable. Even if we were the number one pick, the number two pick is not very far behind us.
Well, what I meant was nowadays in the modern world, we are much more replaceable when it comes to business and trading partners versus in the Stone Age.
That's correct.
Today, are we as replaceable with our friends and mates as we were in the Stone Age?
Oh, probably not. I mean, we're probably very replaceable today where we were not as replaceable in the Stone Age. So in the Stone Age, you didn't have that many people. And so these relationships were, very long-standing. And so think about your best friend from high school, and then think about that the last 15 years that you've been living, the two of you went on, 700 hunts, almost died 7 times, and and went through tremendous hardships and saved each other's lives 3 or 4 times. Now, how do you feel about the guy? Okay.
Yeah.
My guess is you're massively more connected to him in that situation than you are connected to your best friend from high school now. And so this is the hardship and challenge and esteem earned and won would be more profound in an environment of greater challenge. And this is what guys find, what happens to them when they are pursuing these very intense group actions, whether they're in military or in sport, where there's very high levels of achievement and a lot of pain and personal sacrifice involved. They form these bonds that they form during those times are much deeper than they form in a business deal.
So it's like an insurance policy where they're not only going to save each other's financially, they're going to save each other's lives.
Yes. Much bigger deal.
Yeah.
Much bigger deal.
Okay. One thing I was reading on these Reddit forums, I mean, some of the stuff is a little bit out there in terms of, terms of, practical application. But one thing that was saying was that, men bond by insincerely insulting each other, whereas women, women will bond by insincerely complimenting each other. What do you think of that?
That's fascinating. I have to say, I never even thought of it, but that's a very interesting observation. And I've certainly recognized the male issue, and the male issue is a very warm process when we insult each other. It's essentially a test that is telling you, I mean, we could talk another day about humor and how humor works. Humor works through the mechanism of somebody losing status on the other end of it. And I believe that is why humor even exists. It's a pleasant experience because someone lost status. And in a village situation, if someone loses status, it's good for you because the status is effectively, or the esteem in the village is effectively a zero-sum game. There's only so much status to be had. Everybody has their little rank ordering of how important they find other people. And you have a certain net average in that village about how much status you've got. And if someone else loses a little bit of status, it can tickle your nervous system. In other words, it's saying, oh, that's a good thing, and that's funny, okay? But what's interesting about it is that if you actually really lose status and a competitor could find that very funny and be laughing, but it could really hurt you. You're embarrassed, okay? And so that's bad for you, but good for him, and that's why he's laughing. But what we find is that in elegantly done humor, that what people do is they create situations where the status loss is not real, that it's actually going to be what I call faux status. And mm-hmm. we tickle the mechanism of status loss, so we find delight in it, but actually we recognize that it's not real. So between friends can needle each other and insult each other, but the insults are not real. And you know the moment in a situation where possibly – it's always going to be in situations where there's going to be other parties around, say two pretty good friends, and they're joking and needling each other, and people are laughing because they're enjoying getting tickled by this issue of people losing status. And so then it turns out that, you know, maybe it's four or five guys and one of his girlfriends is there, and then somebody is really kind of interested in this guy's girlfriend. And so he cracks a joke about our guy with the girlfriend, and it's not faux status loss. It's not false. It's actually real. And he's actually coming after the guy's status by pointing out a liability or embarrassing deficiency. And he may laugh, and some other people may laugh, but our guy is not laughing. Okay, this is what's called, hey, that's not funny. Okay? So you're, So you're going to, so if you track status gains and losses in this, we can see how humor works, and we can see how that when it's faux status, it's actually a way of signaling to somebody, the best humor is signaling to them maybe a foible where it's not a serious status loss, but in my ability to risk making fun of you, I'm taking a risk that you are going to interpret it the right way and that I'm not actually costing you any real status in some upside-down way. What it tells you is that I feel bonded to you and affectionately towards you, okay? And so really I'm signaling esteem while we play this game, and you can enjoy it. You know, that's when you can laugh at somebody making fun of you, because you see a little bit of truth in it and you appreciate the creativity, but you also appreciate that they have not really cost you status and they have in fact signaled their affection for you. And so this is how, you know, males will play that game with each other. Whereas it's interesting that I don't think females do it as much. I think it's a fascinating insight and I never thought of it. And the fact that females insincerely flatter each other is just fascinating.
We'll have to think on it a little bit more.
Yeah, we're going to have to think about that.
I don't know.
Somebody needed to do a little research.
Yeah, I don't know the truth about it, but every girl that I've told that to is like, oh my God, that's totally true. We do.
Yes.
We never mean what we say when we're complimenting each other about our hairs and our outfits and our boyfriends and whatever. So.
Yes, that's a fascinating insight, and I'm glad somebody said it. Yeah, there you go.
All right, fantastic. We got one more question, and well, we got a couple more, but one general one about the Political Differences podcast.
Yeah.
Okay, so the user writes that he disagrees with the caricature of liberal views on the social safety net. A lot of left-wing charity goes to supporting the arts. So culture matters, whereas raw capitalism leans towards playing it safe. And speaking of arts, he was disappointed that there was not a single word about the importance of empathy in the creative arts and how that might play into the liberals' views. How many creative people aren't celebrities, for instance?
I actually, quite frankly, I can't even quite. He's got some points he's trying to make there, but I'm not even sure what they are. Sorry about that. I can't follow.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I was trying to clarify as well, and I didn't succeed either.
He's trying to say something important, but I can't quite map out what he's getting at. But we're glad if he clarifies that for us, we're glad to talk about that next week.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.